learn about the statistics of where those pieces go together. No representation of, say, actual cities and distances between them, or who you are, or anything like that. And then they try to reconstruct what is the statistically most probable continuation, given you've got a set of tokens. That's why we call them next token predictors, or I once called them autocomplete on steroids. That's what they are, they're autocomplete on steroids. And that gives the illusion of intelligence, but it is really just an illusion. So it works some of the time and not others. The same process drives a hallucination as a correct answer. In both cases, it's just coming up with something statistically probable. So I wrote a Substack a few weeks ago about my friend Harry Shearer. Do we have any Spinal Tap fans in the house? Woo! All right. So Harry Shearer is an American entertainer who was born in Los Angeles, and he's known for Spinal Tap. Any Simpsons fans in the house? Harry Shearer does Mr. Burns and like five other voices. So he happens to be a friend of mine, and he sent me a biography that was written about him by a large language model. And it said that Harry Shearer was a British entertainer, comedian, etc. He's actually born in L.A. He said this before we were going to have breakfast in L.A., which made it all the funnier. And you ask, why does the system do this? Well, what these systems do is they cluster words that are similar together. So they'll put a whole bunch of things that are similar to vast hyperdimensional space, basically, and dimensional space. And so Harry Shearer winds up like near John Cleese. And so some people in that cluster are British entertainers. So from the perspective of a system that does this kind of statistical analysis, it's perfectly plausible. What these systems don't do is to look stuff up or sanity check their own work. So I wrote this long Substack going in detail to all the hallucinations in a short thing about him. It also said that the name of his character was like David, some of their other Smith or something. And anybody who's seen the movie knows his character's name is Derek Smalls. It just made up, it's just wrong. You go to the first page of his Wikipedia entry, all of that stuff is explained. We have this illusion that these things are smart because they mimic so much stuff. But if they were smart, they would check what they're saying against Wikipedia. When I gave my TED talk, which I happened to give right here in this building a couple of years ago, I used the example of one of these systems saying that Elon Musk in 2018 died in a car crash. Well, obviously Elon Musk didn't die in a car crash. We have evidence every day that he's alive. If there's anybody that we know is still alive, it's Elon Musk. He's on Twitter like 24/7. There's news articles written about him 24/7. Obviously, there's a lot. Any intelligent system would weigh the evidence and be like, this is insane. He couldn't have died in 2018. But these systems are not smart enough to do that. They're just autocomplete on steroids. And if you do the autocomplete thing, you have like Elon Musk owns Tesla. Some people who own Teslas died in car crashes. It's not even reasoning, but it's looking at the probabilities of these words in proximity to one another. And, you know, he might be in some news articles where somebody else died. You know, Joe Smith died in a Tesla crash. Elon Musk gave no comment or something like that. And then it scrambles all that up and you get this spew that we call hallucinations.
And there's more and more work at these tech companies that have invested so much time and energy into these models to try and ground them in the truth and to try to do work trying to understand how they come to the conclusions that they do so that they can, you know, maybe make fixes to that. Do you feel like that work is valuable in some regard? Do you see a place in the AI landscape for these generative models in some form, or do you feel like that's
well? That was two questions. So
it is two questions that you gave.
Yeah. So I mean, it's fine, but I'm just going to separate them out. I see some use for these systems. Mm-hmm. I do not see much hope for curing hallucinations. So the uses are in domains where hallucinations don't matter. For example, because the cost of an error is not that high. For example, coding is actually a great application. It's not perfect because of the slop squatting problem and so forth, but in general, the users there are people who know how to debug errors. And they're very attentive to errors. Like, you don't become a good software developer if you don't understand debugging, which is kind of like a Sherlock Holmes problem-solving thing. So if you can do that stuff, you can become a programmer. If you can't do that stuff, you won't make it through Computer Science 101. You give up and you'll be like, this is not for me, which happens to some people, right? But some people get it, some people don't. But the people who make their living as coders can all do it, right? And so when it creates a hallucination, which it does all the time, coding, they can find the error and fix it. I mean, there is a joke that used to take like 12 hours to type your code and, you know, an hour to debug it. Now it can be like 2 minutes to code it and with a machine, and it might take 24 hours to debug it. Because like you're debugging somebody else's code, right? When you write your own code, you kind of know how it works. So debugging someone else's code is a problem. But in general, it can help because there's a human in the loop paying attention who's competent to solve it. Whereas, like, if you have to give medical advice and it says something that stupid and does not fit you, you might not catch it. Imagine you have it give advice for your kid. It hasn't asked enough questions, and it answers on analogy to things that have been told to an adult. And you give it a dose that's four times big, but you're not a doctor, and you don't know. And so you give 2,000 milligrams, where for your kid it should have been 200 or whatever. So there are applications where it's not useful, and there are applications where it are, and it mostly is a question about cost of error and things like that. But to your other part of the question, are the hallucinations going away? Not like this. It might be that large language models are a component in a larger system. They do have their value. But they're not competent on their own. They're always going to be black boxes, by which I mean you know what the input is, you know what the output is, but you don't really know how you get there, and you don't really know in advance whether it's going to be right. So you can't do proofs as we do in some parts of computer science. So for example, Windows device drivers, there's formal proof that they work. Certain parts of airplane navigation systems, there's formal proof that they work. There's never any formal proof whatsoever in an LM. It's always hit or miss, or there's a lovely phrase from an Israeli AI company, which is called prompt and pray. You write the best prompt you can imagine, and you pray that it works. And maybe it does, and maybe it works on Tuesdays and not Thursdays, and you have no idea why. I did a prompt the other day. I was testing some of the visual stuff, and I said, draw a picture of a person with a monocle, okay? And this is with Grok. Monocle on their left eye. This friend of mine noticed they had a lot of trouble with left and right, so I was trying to say. And instead of giving me a person, it gave me a gorilla, and it gave two monocles. Now, why did it do that? It's not because it confused the it's not really because it confused a person with a gorilla, but because I'd asked a question earlier in the session about a person. I have two people shaking hands, or shaking their left hand. And we have what's called a context buffer, which nowadays can be a lot. And so it confused something else in the context in this insane way. And so you never know when that's going to happen. Never can be able to trust it, and you can never look inside.
Let's talk about other areas that you would want to see more investment and research into. So what are the other areas of AI that you feel are not getting enough attention or funding right now?
Number one at the top of my list, though there's probably arguments for others, but the thing I know the best is neurosymbolic AI, which is what I was talking about in my 2001 book. And the idea is that large language models and the family that they're part of, which we call neural networks, have some genuine value. They're good at making statistical summaries of the world, for example. They're not good at things like reason. Classical AI is also what we call symbolic AI. That looks like computer programming or algebra or logic in philosophy and so forth. You have operations over variables. The reason that I called that book the algebraic mind is because, to quote, this is Bishop Berkeley that I quoted at the beginning of the book, thought is a kind of algebra. So there's some piece of our thought where we manipulate these algebraic abstractions. Anybody who's ever computer programmed for more than a week understands what that is. You write these functions and you manipulate variables. That has to be part of the answer because it gives you the generalization that you need and that large language models aren't. So somehow, we have to bring these together. There's a really good metaphor here for many people, which is many people probably know Daniel Kahneman. Some people have read Thinking Fast and Slow. In that book, he talks about what he calls System 1 and System 2. And System 1 is fast, reflexive, statistical, automatic. And System 2 is deliberative, it's reasoning. And, the human mind does both. It doesn't always integrate them well. I actually wrote a whole book about that called Kluge, about why it is we don't integrate them well. But we have those two, they balance each other. We need that in AI.
You've argued for that kind of hybrid system that combines these different kinds of artificial intelligence together. And what would you, in your mind, be able to achieve with that kind of a system that we can't achieve today with either types of architecture?
So you get interpretability straight out of the gate, so you can understand at least what the symbolic system is doing. You want to maybe use the neural network part as input somewhere, but somewhere you want to have symbolic representations that are interpretable, that are much more debuggable. So what happens when a large language model fails? You just add more data. It's very different from a classical system where you figure out, where's the bug? How do I fix it? You can't really do that in a large language model. But if you have a neurosymbolic system, you can do some debugging on those lines to get some advantages out of the gate. What I think ultimately you get is a chance to solve what we call the alignment problem. So the alignment problem is these systems don't do what we ask them to do. We say don't tell people about biological weapons, and they do anyway. But the Apple system problem is they don't hallucinate, and the system's hallucinating so much they have to take them off the market. What you can get with symbolic systems is you can have explicit constraints about how things work or don't work, have the system actually obey them. You can talk to them in the language of computer programming, or maybe in human language, although there's some qualifications there. You can be much more direct with the system and expect them to do what you want. If we're going to put the hook these things up essentially to the entire universe, like our planet, to all the infrastructure and so forth, we should know that we can guarantee that they function properly. It is insane what we're doing now, hooking these things up like in military contexts and so forth, when we know that they're not reliable. And soon, like, you know, most of the U.S. government is going to run on these things. I mean, imagine you need some government service in the United States now, and you try to talk to a chatbot, and, you know, it doesn't work, and how do you even get a human on the line? I just had that experience with Google. This is not pleasant, and it's not functional. Like, yeah. I think what we're going to see in the next year is the quality of services in the United States is going to go down markedly, because people who know what they're doing are going to be replaced by machines that don't know.
Well, these large language models are also, I think the companies that are making them are starting to see it's harder and harder to improve performance over time. So as that plateaus, do you feel like some of these companies might switch some of their focus to symbolic systems or other architectures?
They might. You know, in the long run, for sure, I think 100%. And just in the last, I would say, 6 months, there's been some wising up. You know, everybody thought they were going to rush to GPT-5 after GPT-4, and it's now been 2.5 years, and it's not for lack of trying, right? It's not even necessarily for lack of data, though we can talk about that. But you know, OpenAI tried to make GPT-5. They had something called Project Orion, and it, I won't say it stank, but it didn't meet expectations. And so they renamed it GPT-4 and half. The thing you're seeing that a lot of people find it to be disappointing was supposed to be GPT-5. So there was that. Grok 3 was supposed to be, like, you know, amazing, and it's fine, but it was like 10 times as expensive as Grok 2, and only a little bit better. And the whole industry has realized that we're getting diminishing returns. There's some talk about these special, quote, reasoning models, we can go into it, but the basic idea that you could solve everything by just adding more data has not really worked. We're going to take another example. O3 is one of the best models out now, and it hallucinates more, not less, than its predecessor. It was this notion that you add more data, everything gets better. It's kind of almost for free. You just need to pour the crack. So people like fought desperately for data. They ripped off artists and writers left and right. You know, they downloaded YouTube videos they didn't have license to. Everybody thought, we get the data and we're good. And what they discovered in the last 6 months, whether they say it publicly or not, is that that's not true. And so they are scrambling a bit. That's making them maybe a little bit more open-minded about how to do this. DeepMind has always been a bit more open-minded than the rest. AlphaFold is actually a hybrid system. It's not a general-purpose one like a chatbot, but it is a hybrid system focused on protein folding. You get the input as a list of nucleotides, a sequence of nucleotides, the output is a three-dimensional protein. So there is some work that's outside the mainstream, but there's also all this wild financial stuff that goes with everybody being part of this fad. And there's this huge, kind of fear of missing out. Like, nobody wants to be not there when AGI happens. And they've all convinced themselves, I think wrongly, that this is the royal path. Most of them, I don't think, ever took a class in cognitive science. If they had, I think they'd be like, yeah, I don't think it's really going to work, which is what I've been trying to tell them for 20 years, 25 years. Slowly it's dawning, but because of this almost like cult-like thing, not that many people have done that much outside the box.
Yeah, I think that's a so-called scaling law that you referred to, that just with more compute, with more data, you know, these models can scale up and at some point develop some semblance of intelligence, maybe even super intelligence. So why do you think that theory has taken such a strong hold on Silicon Valley in particular, and what is the fundamental flaw that you see there?
I mean, I can think of this old book about mass delusions, right? I mean, you know, people thought that tulips were going to be worth an infinite amount of money, right? Ideas just set hold, and there are economics behind them, and so forth. So, like, for example, it is the interest of every investor to keep this myth alive, because investors get paid in two ways. One is if they have a big hit, but the other is if they get 2% of the money they're investing. And so if the money they're investing is in the billions, they get rich immediately off the 2% of, I guess it's called carrot, they get rich immediately. So they're not going to be here when it all falls apart. They're already going to have made, you know, $1,500 million. They're perfectly happy. So they're very incented to make this kind of deal. And then that means they hype it. We have people working in the media. I won't, you know, name names, but people in the media who basically they're so-called AI influencers. And their beat is to tell you that, like, AGI is going to be here next week, and they get followers because people, you know, want to be here at this magical moment. You know, think back to an earlier era with, like, selling snake oil. Like, some of it is, like, a cult-like thing. People want to be there in the moment. There are different reasons for different people. But I think by now the evidence, like, it's a hypothesis. The hypothesis was scaling will get us to AGI. And now, you know, we've spent $500 billion collectively testing that hypothesis. More money, I think, than any hypothesis in history has ever gotten. And everybody keeps getting the same results. It's insane. You have like 20 different companies doing the same experiments, getting the same results from the same data. Like, hello?
In your latest book, Taming Silicon Valley, you referred to OpenAI as the next WeWork, talking about how an overinflated company might make a sudden collapse. So I guess I gotta ask you, like, do you think we're in an AI boom or an AI bubble right now?
We're in a bubble. I mean, LLMs are not going anywhere. They're useful technology, and now they're cheap because everybody's building the same thing. That leads to a price war. So, like, they're cheap enough that they'll have some utility in the world. But so far, the revenue has been like $7 billion against $500 billion expenditure. So, you know, it's a financial bubble. The companies like OpenAI, in my view, are overvalued. And, I mean, you look at NVIDIA, which is one parameter of this, and it was going up and up and up like a rocket. And the last year, I think it's made 20% as compared to the year before, it like tripled or whatever it did. You know, even NVIDIA seems to have slowed down. And they're the company that are selling shovels in the gold rush. The fact that they're slowing down is because some people are realizing this is not quite as good as the media campaigns of companies like OpenAI led us to believe. Now, I just saw a study that said 7,000 companies were surveyed to see whether AI actually affected their bottom line. And the answer was no. And at some point when people realize they're paying all this money, they're doing these trials, they're never reliable enough, the hallucinations never go away, companies start to pull back. So some companies will be able to make use of it, but it was sold as this like universal thing, like snake oil was going to solve absolutely everything, and it's not, and people are wise enough.
Do you think that's true in the general public as well? Like, do you feel the sentiment shifting, where there's been so much hype and buzz and enthusiasm for some of these early tools, ChatGPT, as people were playing with them, but then are we now kind of coming to a moment where folks are feeling
different? You're not old enough to remember pet rocks, but maybe somebody in the audience is. I mean, people got all excited about rocks as pets, or with a Furby, it was a, you know, little stuffed animal.
You remember Furby.
Furbies learned to speak, except it was all a cheat, it was a fraud, right? Because what Furbies would, I mean, fraud's too strong a word, but what, lawyers, please edit that up. The Furbies, it was a trick. They had built in simpler language, and then a couple days later, it'd be more complicated language. And so you had the illusion that you were teaching them. But, you know, it was a fad for a while. It was like the best-selling toy, and then people got tired of it. I think some people are getting tired of LLM. Some aren't, but some people definitely are. They're like, I thought it was going to get better, and it hasn't. I'm starting to see even some of these so-called AI influencers that make their living writing hypey tweets on the internet to start to, you know, express some disappointment. Like, we're not getting what we were promised. And, you know, that seems like the leading edge of something like that.
Well, you've given us a lot to think about here on opening night, Gary. Thank you so much for your time. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Marcus there from the opening night of Web Summit Vancouver in conversation with Amy Nordrum. Interesting conversation there about AI and where it's at, where it's going, how real the hype is. According to Gary, don't buy the hype. This is Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We'll have more coverage of Web Summit Vancouver next week after I attend tomorrow's final day of the conference. Have at least one, hopefully a couple interviews to share with you from that. And now we're into the home stretch of this episode of Speak Up, and I'm going to wrap things up with just a little bit of music before we head over to Democracy Now. This track by Ramen Fog is called Bubba. See you next week.
Hi, my name is Lowell, and you're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, Simon Fraser Campus Radio.
Would you give me a beat?
CJSF 90.1 FM is the campus radio station for Simon Fraser University, located on Burnaby Mountain in BC, Canada. CJSF 90.1 FM, diverse, independent, yours. Check us out on SoundCloud or at cjsf.ca.
Good morning. It's Charlotte Farrell, your own Sister C, here in the place to be, CJSF Radio 90.1 in Burnaby. We just danced our way awake with Soul Mikasa.
Yeah, I'm a young black man who uses art to champion and celebrate blackness, as well as creating art that showcases black men as comprehensive, emotionally intelligent human beings.
Right now, we are going to hear a spoken word rap piece by slam poetry winner JB, the First Lady. That is Lady Johnny Proby singing Don't Quit, and here at Speak Up, we do not quit. Love, laughter, argument, and encouragement. The words are too few for the essence of you. And it shows just one of the ways that you can take feelings of pain and transform them to love and recognition. Today, we're exploring senior issues through digital media and the creative arts. My guests are Leslie Riemann, the director of the 411 Center, and Joel Flynn from PodStream. This is Charlotte Farrell, your own Sister C, welcoming you to the Friday Speak Up, Listen Up, Act Upon What You've Heard show. We have conversations about social issues, culture, and creative arts events, potent samplings about special months like Health Month, Black History Month, Women's Month, Nutrition Month, and more. See you Friday at 10 a.m.
And plans prayed on and God saying now talk to your fam, express thanks for your breath and acknowledge the land, remember those who did not get a chance, the story's not over, the plot can advance. I feel the fresh air walking in Van City, I'm walking in Vans. I take them off and I hop in the sands and handle biz with vision and purpose, mission and service, embrace pain and celebrate the good. No mechanic, but we elevate the hood. Take a look, try to put things back the way it should.
On the cloudiest of days, I feel lost inside of all this pain. Lost inside of this pain.
Thank you. music and podcasts from CGSF 90.1 FM with our radio app. It's on-the-go listening made easy. You can tune into all our music, spoken word, and multicultural shows using your device. Our app lets you set reminders so you'll never miss your favorite show again. Stay connected to CGSF 90.1 FM through our community radio app. Download the app from the Apple Store or get it on Google Play.